time. Anyway, Mike Woodruff has been working in the human-robot interaction for a while. He's done some really neat stuff with humans and teams of robots. Also put in his dues in a number of service-oriented responsibilities for the community. And I'm very happy that he's here today to give us a talk on this. And I'm going to actually cut it short so that he can spend more time talking. So go for it.
Thanks, Aaron.
Oh, Brigham Young University, if you haven't figured it out.
Yeah, if you can't tell. Happy to take questions as I go along. And if there's questions outside of my domain, I'll just tell you I don't know, because I am going to present results that include all the faculty members who are working on this particular project. All right, so I'll try to put their names there. If I forget and you see them, and you please don't tell them I took credit for their work. All right, they're a little sensitive. All right, here's the problem domain. It turns out that recently I've really become enamored with socially relevant problems. And it's kind of a new experience for me. And the problem that we're looking at, I live in Utah, and Utah has some beautiful, pristine wilderness areas. And about 2.5 years ago, they lost an 11-year-old up in the mountains, and they never found him. And it was really sad. Tremendous amounts of efforts to find him. And then the last summer, a boy got lost, and he was lost for 3 days, and then he was found. And a person who works on campus, he's not a faculty member, he's a staff member, volunteers with Utah County Search and Rescue, and he knew of the work by Randy Beard and Tim McLean building UAVs. And so he suggested it'd be a really good idea if we could take some of these UAVs and see if we can find lost people. And so that's what we've been working on. And so the problem is, the biggest problem with doing this is there's no budget and you don't have trained operators. When I talk about no budget, it's really important that you understand that for these search and rescuers, they don't get paid, and for this particular type of search and rescue, they have to invest about $5,000 of their own money for equipment before they can even take part in this sort of work. All right, and they're going to be trained in certain areas. So they might be trained at rappelling, they might be trained in emergency, but they're not going to be trained as pilots probably. So there's some severe constraints. Now, in terms of how quickly you need to find somebody, think about the average speed that someone's going to walk in the wilderness is about 3 kilometers per hour. And that means that the radius is going to grow, the search radius is going to grow about 3 kilometers per hour, which means the search area, which grows with the square of that, gets really, really big, really, really fast. And that's a problem. And the idea that we're looking at is we want to have cheap equipment that can be deployed very quickly and can be used by people who aren't pilots. And as we've envisioned this, we picture a new technical search team. So you'll have some people that are good at going into caves and doing searches, and you'll have other people who are good at rappelling down a mountain and helping somebody on the side of a cliff. And this would be a new technical search team that would work with these other groups. So that's kind of the background. We've done a number of field tests, and in this image you'll see our victim, not especially realistic victim, on top of a rock wearing bright orange. Right? That was very nice. This is the kind of thing we're doing early to try to get better at this. All right? And what we've done is we've had a number of field tests. Here's three. There's a whole bunch of small tests and then some larger tests that involve some search and rescue people. And after these field tests, I was just curious about what technology they thought was mature and what technology they thought was important. So I had them rank technologies. I had 10 people, 7 or 10 people, I forget, rank their technology. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through almost in order a couple of these technologies until we run out of time. All right, there's the plan. So we're going to start with hardware. It turns out it's hard to do aerial search if you don't have reasonable hardware. So the technology that we're using is the Procerus Autopilot, which has a little CPU and a bunch of sensors on it. It's got GPS, it's got some altitude sensors and so on. And this thing goes on a small aircraft. The one you're seeing here is a Zagy airframe. And notice the hot glove as he throws it. Little hand launch things. Now the reason why he's so elated is not because they got one flying, but he had a new system on here. He was trying to, currently the way the system works is you throw it, and then somebody pushes a button to engage the propellers. You don't want the propellers going while your hand is still behind it, right? That's a push propeller. Okay, shall we play it? So he was just doing a very simple little thing where he had a photoresistor that his finger covered, and he was using the accelerometers to detect a large acceleration. And when the photoresistor was clear and the acceleration was large, he moved it, it turned the propeller on automatically. And that's why he had the hot glove on. Okay, just giving you a feel for the kind of technology. Now, one of the things that would be nice if we could autonomously track something on the ground. And so what you're going to see here is work done by Randy Beard and Tim McLean. And what they're doing, in the image, there is an object which they're tracking. And this is kind of a funny tracking thing. There's a vehicle that's moving, and they're actually putting the mouse over where that vehicle is, and then they're autonomously planning where the UAV goes. So this isn't vision-based search. They have some vision-based search algorithms, right? But this one is, I'm going to give you a direction I want the UAV to go, and then you autonomously plan how you can get the UAV to go there. All right? Now, the ability to autonomously plan so that you can circle a location is a critical technology for doing aerial search. This is going to be, first little bit is going to be fairly high level, and we're going to skip through things pretty quickly. I apologize if it's too fast. Okay, now, it's great to get the vehicle up. What's the rule about airplanes? Landing, takeoff is optional, landing is mandatory. And one of the problems with these things is they're very small, they're made out of foam, and you belly land them. And it's desirable, especially where we're flying out in this, these types of regions, it's desirable that you land them pretty close to where you take off, and in such a way that the batteries don't split open and catch things on fire. Right? I have this great fear that someday I'm going to cause a wilderness fire flying UAVs around. So we don't want to teleoperate this coming in. As much as possible, we don't want somebody on the radio control bringing this thing in. So they developed an algorithm that will spiral down, and then you give it an approach vector, and then based on that spiral down point and the approach vector, when it gets to a particular altitude in its spiral, it'll break out of that, and it will follow a vector in and always land exactly, pretty close to where you want it to. Okay? And that's really nice because when you're up in the mountains, surrounded by trees, you might only have a certain avenue that you can land that airplane. One of the great stories that happened with this one is they put the landing point inside the spiral down point while they were still experimenting with this. So it gets down to the altitude, and then it lands, right, straight into the ground.
How do you take into account wind?
This one didn't model wind. Okay, some of them do model wind, and what they do when the UAV is flying in the wind, if the wind's coming from this direction, we're trying to go this way, it will crab. And so if they get a mean wind velocity, and what they're doing is they're doing some sort of optic flow over the ground to get a ground velocity versus how fast the UAV says it's going, and they'll get a mean velocity for that, and they'll try to compensate for that. This particular algorithm didn't use that.
Can we see that movie again?
You want to see that one again?
At this point, who is controlling the airplane?
This is autonomous. On the interface, they specify that we want you to spiral down over in this region. I can't even see it right there. There it is. Spiral down this region, so you'll see it do a couple of gentle loops. Once it gets to an altitude threshold, it'll take off on the vector that they specified and try to aim for a landing point. And they've actually done, in the absence of wind is a big thing. In the absence of wind, they've done several of these trials. And they found that, they were like plus or minus 5 meters from the target point. So it was pretty good on 5 or 6 trials with it. Of course, the one you're seeing is the one where it lands exactly on the blanket.
The predictive ability of that blanket is really impressive.
Yeah, we had several that we edited out. All right. Now, this is my favorite one. This is where we do a lot of our field tests, and they were trying to catch it. All right. Okay, so the reason they were trying to catch it is because it's got a dome on the bottom to protect the camera. And you land it too much and you scratch up the dome. All right, so we learned that didn't work.
Analyzing from those two examples, it really hits for the red.
That's what it looks like, huh? Yeah, that's what we do with graduate students where I'm at. Okay, now, you got to get the thing up in the air, so it's nice to have some autonomy. When you launch it, it spirals up and it waits for the next command. It's really nice if you can say to go to a particular area. It'd be even better if you could do that with vision. And then bringing it home is really nice too. But in terms of search tactics is a phrase that's used by search and rescuers to say, how do we go out into this area and decide what we're going to do? You better have at least two other things. And one thing is some ability to track waypoints, of course. And the other one is some ability to do attitude stabilization. Now, what I mean by that is most UAVs use a form of waypoint following, where you go to this point, you may loiter there, or there may be a sequence of waypoints. We have a working hypothesis that we're now finally testing after 2.5 years of sharing our working hypothesis, that for certain types of search, it's better to reactively modify your path based on cues that you're seeing. And in order to do that, it's very difficult to do that with waypoints. In a minute, I'll share one of the incidents that happened when we tried to do this. So the video that I showed you is a little PDA-based display that we used. And I'm showing you this for two reasons. First, I think it's really cool. And the second reason is we're doing some stabilization things, which is a fundamental building block. People, we don't want these non-pilots to have to worry about RCing this. But it's very simple to say, turn this way by grabbing the wing of the airplane and going that direction. So you're going to see some things right now. He's issuing commands that say, you know, go north, south, east, or west. Very small to see. After the beautiful transition, you're going to see he controls the airplane by grabbing a wing. And when he grabs the wing, you'll see that the airplane banks right. And the autonomy in this case is simply providing a capability that says stabilize around this attitude. All right? Not very sophisticated, but pretty useful, as we'll talk about. All right, let's talk about video. The biggest problem with this video is these UAVs are small. These are fixed wings, so they're not going to hover. And we can't be very high. We've got to fly in the hobby airspace. And so the net result of all of this, so we're not using the most fantastic cameras ever, the next result, net result is you end up with video which is incredibly jittery. So I probably should have challenged you to go ahead and keep track of which direction is north. So go ahead. We started off north. Oh, and keep track of how many red umbrellas you see. I may have failed to mention that. How'd you do? I have no idea. Yeah, I think you could do that if that's all you were doing. Right? So at the end, you might be able to say, I'm pointed north. Well, where are you? I don't know. What did you see? A road. Right? So it's really important to find better ways to represent that information. And the simplest form is simply to do stabilization. Now I'm going to give a disclaimer here. This is work that was done by a colleague of mine, Brian Morse, and some of his students. And so you're going to see a slide about the computer vision algorithms they use, and we're going to stay on it for about that long. All right? And what it's going to say is they tracked features. Okay? Real time. All right. So it would be a lot better if the video just didn't bounce around. And so what he's doing here is he's trying to keep the center of the image. He's trying to have that progress in a smooth path so you don't get this high frequency stuff. You think you could track an object in this a little bit better than with the unstabilized?
Only a little bit.
Yeah, I couldn't. We thought you could. We'll show you some data that says you really can't. Okay, here's our... All right. The second method is to do some mosaics. And mosaics offer a big improvement. So what I want you to do here is I want you to keep track of which way is north and see if you can track objects. You can see that they're doing some things in the previous videos. Straight roads were curved, so they're doing some things where they remove those artifacts from the camera. They're calibrating the camera. And then they're just stitching things together. Now, this is only a local mosaic. And we're not doing structure for motion stuff here. When I say we, I mean they. They're not doing structure for motion stuff. And what they're simply doing is they are doing a projection. And finding features, and then assuming that all the images are the same, even if you're going up and down and so on, and stitching those together as well as they can. Okay? And same kind of thing. All right. What if you put those two things together? Oh, you had a question?
Is that in real time, or is that a batch process?
So this one was batch. This is actually running at, I think, 4x. Okay, so they can do this. They does this in real time, and real time he gets about 15 frames a second. Okay, he's not using the GPU on it. All right, so he's using the CPU, and this is because, you know, sometimes student, no offense, sometimes student code is just hacks. Okay, yes.
Of course, I wish I could code. How do you envision this being used if it's sort of an offline?
No, so this is intended to be an online process. This is real time. So we're getting 15 frames a second returning to us.
Oh, okay.
That's going to be stabilized or constructed into a mosaic. Okay. Now it's a local mosaic, which means that once it's off the edge here, we forget it.
Right.
We're not trying to build a global mosaic. And the reason we're doing that is because we don't have good structure for motion type of thing, and there's a slow drift in what's happening here. I shouldn't have put this in because I know the very least about the computer vision stuff. Okay, stabilized. So what? Before this thing was bouncing all the way around, and this is now we're still building the mosaic, but we're trying to keep this center point following a smooth path. Now this is, there's nothing new here, especially with computer vision, right? But we did an experiment with this, and in the experiment it was intended to be something similar to what. A searcher might have to do is a secondary task experiment. The primary task was to watch this video and mark when you saw a red umbrella. Okay? And the way you marked it is you click in it, clicking pauses it, then you move a mouse over the object, and you click again and that marks it. Right? The secondary task, every 7 to 15 seconds, something like that, I forget the exact numbers. Something would flash up and you'd have to mark the red square over here. Right? Now the reasoning was if you're doing this in real time and you have a searcher who is both the UAV pilot and the UAV video analyst, that they're going to have to be doing control types of tasks at the same time as looking at the video. Right? Now they had 26 subjects. Now the difference between 14 naive and 12 biased subjects is the 14 naive subjects were just recruited from the general student population. The 12 biased subjects were friends of the experimenter, okay, and they knew what the result wanted to be. Now, I just do that in the interest of honesty here. It turns out there was no difference on any of the cases between these, right? Even though they knew what was wanted, there was still no difference, which I think you saw pretty quickly. The mosaic provided a lot of information. So they did their statistical analysis, and they found that the probability of detection goes up a huge amount anytime you have a mosaic. And just plain stabilization isn't very good. In fact, some of the data suggests that the original was better than just plain stabilization, although that doesn't show here. The mosaics yield higher hit rates, they produce less stress in people, and they were easier to use. So we have both objective and subjective judgment. Now, interestingly, they also had more false alarms. The reason is simple. Why do they work? Well, because I can see stuff longer. In this picture right here, this is from the original video, there's a red umbrella right here. Okay? And you see it in one frame, it's about 1/15 of a second, something like that, you get to see it. All right? In this one, it persists long enough. And so simply put, a mosaic just makes stuff last so people see it more often. That's also why they have more false alarms. So if up here there was a little bit of a red dot that happened to appear, you would be more likely to say that that's a false alarm, right? In this field, false alarms probably aren't as important as misdetections. Now, the student who did this was really pleased because people were more confident in their ability to use mosaics than to use a standard or the stabilized video. And that concerns me a little bit because there's a real overconfidence problem. When you have a searcher out there, they have to report back to the incident commander how well they did with the search. How thorough they were. And if they report back that they've had complete coverage and absolutely no problems, that's going to be a problem, right? So we need to talk about the social issue of how do you calibrate people's confidence. All right. Any questions about that other than the computer vision stuff that I skipped? Aaron will be happy to take those offline after I take my flight. Okay, so if the principle is that things that stay on the screen longer are better, it'd be really nice if we could just have all the images come back. So this is new work. A typical panoramic camera is pretty heavy, and these things don't have a big payload. All right, and as much of the payload as you can get into batteries, the better. Okay, so the Zaggy that you saw, that could stay up there for about a half an hour. The one we're using for the search field test now has about 2 hours of life airtime. Okay, which isn't a whole bunch. So you want a minimum battery, well, maximum battery, and minimum weight from anything else. So it's difficult to get a fisheye lens. It has a real heavy camera on there. And so a student was just trying the simple idea. Let's just put three cameras. Let's aim them in slightly different directions. And all I'm going to give you here is just a brief touch on what he's done, mostly a demo. And I've got to show the demo over here. So the idea is I have three cameras aimed slightly different, and it gives me two options. I can either get a panoramic video, or I can do a type of virtual gimbaling, similar to what many people have done and I've seen demonstrated here today. How am I doing? Let's skip the video. You've seen stuff like this before. Hasn't flown yet. A real interesting thing occurred. We had these fantastic interfaces, and we were experimenting in a field test. And it was very apparent very early on that everybody was crowding around the little video display that we had and ignoring stabilized imagery and so on. They were ignoring that. And I was concerned by that, since I was being funded to develop the other stuff. The difference was, when this image was digitized and displayed on the computer, things were happening with the hues and the way color was represented that wasn't happening on the simple video display. Right? And so it shouldn't have surprised me that bright oranges appeared very clearly on the TV display, but not so well on the computer. Well, that just suggests that a very simple way of emphasizing colors which are different from the background would be useful. Okay? And so you see a little display where this is one that is a red umbrella, and this is one that just boosts the saturation level of that red umbrella. We got to test this in practice, because it's only, you know, students feeling good about computer vision, and there's a difference between feeling good about the vision algorithm and then seeing if searchers can use this. So that's the next phase that has to happen with this. Okay.
Are there any video?
I do have some videos of it. Do you want to see them?
Yes.
Okay.
You have time.
I have time. This would be a good time to do whatever that's asking me to do. So this is without the saturation, and there's going to be a red umbrella that's going to appear here. It's a little bright, so you might not be able to see it at all. It's already passed.
Yeah.
You see it?
Yeah.
Well, let's try the new and improved one. Do you see it?
Mm-hmm.
It pops out, doesn't it? Okay, that's what we hope. Now, there's some issues with this. As long as the people who are lost are wearing bright red or bright orange, this technique will work really well. Okay, so people who are doing rifle hunting, it probably will work. People who are doing bow hunting and out there in the camouflage, colored, you know, covered in all sorts of elk scents, they're going to be much more difficult to find. All right, because if you just subtract, it's basically a form of subtracting out the background, mean background color. All right, so that's going to be an issue.
If the color is rare, would you also want to make it brighter?
I don't know. Seems like you would. And it seems like if it's that far out of it, you would just go, look here, right? Rather than just saying, here's the object. And I think that that's be an interesting user study to do.
You may have said this, but this field of view, how on the ground, how long? What's the size?
You're talking about pixels, or you're talking about the field of view?
Huh? Yeah, on the ground. How long is this?
What's the scale?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't say that. I think we have a 30-degree field of view camera here.
So that red dot corresponds to how big?
Okay, so here's a road. This isn't probably big enough to fit an ATV, two ATVs on it side to side. All right, so what is that, maybe 8 feet across? And this is a pretty big umbrella. It's probably a golf umbrella. And it's, you know, we got some leaking over here because of the problems with the issues with the camera. That's the scale we're looking at. Now, there's a reason why we've got this altitude. We've got to have this altitude, or it turns out we run into trees and ridges. The area that we're searching, we try to get minimum numbers of trees. We've got enough trees to be interesting, but not so much that we can't see the ground. And we also want enough terrain to be interesting, but not so much that we run into the side of the mountain. And that puts us about this altitude with this field of view camera. All right. Okay, I want to talk just briefly about height above ground. And the reason I want to talk about this is because of an incident, we'll call it, that happened on one of our field tests. The interface that was being used was a waypoint interface. And the operator, we saw something that was a point of interest. Turned out to not to be the victim. But we saw something that was interesting in a region. And so what the operator planned on doing was putting a waypoint here and a waypoint here, and then flying back and forth between these waypoints. Right? Pretty good strategy for gathering imagery that way. These particular waypoints, you had to specify the altitude. All right? And there was an autonomous height above ground. Well, one waypoint was on this side of the ridge. The other waypoint was on the other side of the ridge. All right? Now, I was going to download the video or the audio so that you could hear the interesting dialogue that took place, but my audio player was out of battery, so I didn't get it downloaded. You hear, "Is that it? Is that it? I think you're going to run into the ground. Is that it? Is that it?" And so people were, on a different display, people were seeing that there was going to be a problem. Okay, so something's got to go. And there's two choices. You can either have autonomous height above ground support, or you could do a better job on your interface telling people that they're going to run into the ground. This is a height above ground. And it's a funny kind of controller. It's not the kind of controller I'm excited about, because it's not using some real-time sensor, right? We're not going to be able to fly a 5-pound laser rangefinder. That's going to weigh more than the rest of our airplane combined. And it's been very difficult to do good closed-loop stuff. So what they're doing instead is they're taking digital elevation map data, and they're flying. So what you're seeing is you're seeing video from the airplane. Telemetry is being fed back in, and we're just portraying that telemetry over a ridge as it flies up over the ridge. So it's basically an open-loop controller. All right? And as long as your ridges are very gentle, no problem. Okay, I live in Utah where, anybody ever been to Provo, Utah? Yeah, you have. Yeah. And the mountains go like this, right? And you just can't count on the UAV to be able to track that. So there's a problem with that. So if you could do something with the interface, that would help too. So what the student's done here is he's just using a two-color system. He's just portrayed safe areas where I can fly and unsafe areas. And if you display those in perspective, you get the sense for when the UAV is going to run into the mountain, okay, which it does. Proof by demonstration. Now, there's all sorts of issues with this. Aaron's probably cringing just a little bit, and well, he should be. Okay, let's talk about autonomy for a minute. Wilderness search and rescue is a complicated process with huge social factors, and you know, these are good, hardworking, honest people who want to do their best, but it's a complicated process. So what we did is I talked to Julie Adams at Vanderbilt, since I don't do goal-directed task analyses and cognitive work analyses, and she helped us interview a couple of subject matter experts to try to understand this process. And she generated just tons of data. And the data that I liked most was this. When people are searching, wilderness search and rescuers use one of four different type of search tactics. This is the one the press talks about. This, you know, combing the area. And people get really upset if the area hasn't been combed. Right? But in terms of search efficiency, this is a search of last resort because it's incredibly inefficient. Right? To gather, have 100 people and gather hands and go across the ground is a huge waste of resources if you have a pretty good idea that the person's not on the fringes. So the first search that they do is they'll do what they call a hasty search. And a hasty search, the goal is, let's see if I can just follow them and find them. Right? And I might use some people who do man tracking, meaning they look at footprints, and they're just incredible at distinguishing between footprints of people and footprints of animals, and there's an incredible science there. And talk about a vision challenge problem, right? They can tell whether the footprint is made by a human or an animal because people have ankles, and so when they step, they displace the dirt just a little bit, and you can't actually see it in the displacement of the dirt, but you get a slight luminance there. And so when the sun is just right, these people will stand back and they can follow where people have gone. It's just an amazing thing. And if you could do that with computer vision, that'd be really nice. Dogs work really well. Now the problem with hasty search is by the time most people call to report that someone's lost, they've already done their own search, right? Which means they gathered five of their closest friends and they polluted the trail. Okay? So it usually isn't very productive. The next thing they do is they try to constrain the search. And in constraining the search, what they'll do is they'll say, here's the point last seen, and I know if they're going to go that direction, they have to cross the snowfield. Well, if somebody crosses a snowfield, I can probably see their tracks. So they'll send a tracker team out there and they'll say, nope, they haven't crossed a snowfield. That means I can constrain my search to this sector instead. Right? That's really important information. Constraining search has other things like they dropped a candy bar. We found a candy bar wrapper over here. This was a kind of candy bar wrapper. We knew they had that candy bar, so they're probably in this sector instead. Right? Those are the kinds of things they do. But these are both tend to be temporary stages, and this is the one where they spend their most time. So what they'll do is they'll talk to the people who know the victim. They'll find out about things like motivation. All right. So not all people who get lost want to be found. It's just the way it is. So I'll give you a kind of a sad example. If you are trying to find somebody who has been depressed in a mountainous region, do you look up or you look down? You look at the bottom of cliffs, right? Because they probably went up there to jump, right? That's horrible, right? If you're looking for a hunter, the hunter probably went to the top of the ridge. You're looking for an elderly person, probably downhill. You and I, assuming we're not hunters, elderly people, or suicidal, probably downhill. Kids who are autistic? And that's a real issue because it turns out a disproportionate number of kids who get lost because they have some issue that makes it difficult for them to follow instructions or take social cues or something like that. So these are really important things. As much as you know, you can use that to constrain the search area, right? And that's really important, finding out their intentions, their health, and so on. If somebody's very old and very feeble, your search area is much smaller, and that's a nice thing. So we're going to talk a little bit about search tactics, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the things I've learned from reading about what people do when they're lost. If we could model victim movement, then ideally we can construct a distribution for where the victim is. Under ideal circumstances, the victim will be distributed in some sort of distribution which is high in the middle and then scales off to the outside. This was a Gaussian distribution. It's got a moving victim. And what you're seeing here is the spiral represents the path of the UAV, and the little square, that represents the footprint of the camera. And we're trying to vacuum up probability. So we're representing this probability distribution using particles, and we're trying to vacuum up the probability here. A quick question for you. Which is the better search, spiraling out or spiraling in from an outer point in terms of accumulating probability? That's exactly right. You spiral out, right? You go to the area which has the highest probability first. It makes sense. At what point do you start and double back in?
Well, but you're assuming that it's a Gaussian.
Oh, totally, yeah.
Is there any studies on where people have been found and can you fit them all into that?
This isn't a study. I'm getting there. I was going to refer to you as segue person, but instead you'll be foreshadow person because we've got one more thing to cover, and we'll talk about that. All right. So it'd be great if I could do this optimal spiral, if there was autonomy for doing this. So how do you do it? Well, it's pretty easy to get a UAV to loiter around a point and focus a gimbal on that point. Okay. The algorithm that we're using in this is real flight data. the algorithm we're using to create these blue loiter points, that is just a hop bifurcation. So you get this thing and you have these vector fields that point you into this cycle. And then this is the equation of a spiral that grows the space between each region of the spiral, and the distance between the sample points of the spiral is uniform, which means you're getting constant sampling. Okay, so you can do these spirals really nice. So as long as the person is kind enough to distribute him or herself in a Gaussian way, we can optimally search for them. People don't often do that. Now, do people walk randomly when they're lost? Yes. Almost everybody gets random when they're lost. Okay. Some real interesting things. Kids from about 8 to about 18, when they get lost in the wilderness, everything that they do makes it worse. Okay. Below 8, they tend to just get tired and sit down after a little while. Right. About adulthood, some people do things that help. But almost everybody, when they get lost, goes through a period where they just panic. Okay, let's talk about that for a minute. What does it mean for a person to be lost? Well, it doesn't mean disoriented. If it meant disoriented, I would always be lost, because I have a terrible sense of direction. A person is lost when they are disoriented and they have no strategy that will reorient them. It's a funny thing when people realize they're lost, what they do. There's some really great guidebooks for being in the wilderness that give really lousy advice. And you can find in print really stupid rules like, all water leads to civilization, which isn't true in the wilderness. A lot of water leads to swampy areas, which is not where you want to be when you're cold, tired, and hungry, and scared, right? But people oftentimes will adopt one of these strategies, but they'll only adopt it for a period of time, right? So somebody might say, well, if I can just get to that ridge to the top, I'll be able to reorient myself. And they'll get halfway up and they'll go, man, I'm tired. Ooh, there's some water. And they go do that. Right? They do, right? There's just a psychology of it. We're laughing because we can picture ourselves doing that, I think. And then what they'll do is they'll say, I know what I'll do is I'll start at this tree and I will spiral out. And they'll do that for 40 minutes. No, that didn't work. I'll start at that tree and I'll spiral out. Ooh, that looks like a game trail. Okay? And people frequently switch between these different reorientation strategies. And at some point, it's pretty common, apparently, for people who are lost to just start running. They just panic. And so you'll find people who are lost, and apparently they'll have scratches all over their face, and they found people who have been running in panic and fallen off the edge of a cliff, and things like that. So a random walk model is actually a fairly realistic model for a lot of behaviors. Okay, so you do probably get a little bit of that distribution. There's this dispersion force that comes just by the fact that you panic. By the way, just as a rule of thumb, what should you do if you get lost in the wilderness? Hug a tree. Yes, you stay put. Okay, what if you have a topo map and a satellite phone? Call somebody. Okay, I got to tell you one funny story. So Brigham Young University is located at the bottom of the mountain range, and the mountains go pretty vertical, right? It's really kind of a lovely area. And there was a young man, and I'm sure he hasn't lived this down. He was lost on the side of the mountain, and he could look out and he could see the city. And he knew that downhill was home, but he was lost and he called search and rescue. Now I could see doing that because there's some pretty significant cliffs there, right? You know what I'm talking about. But he wasn't anywhere near the cliffy area, right? So he was pretty close to some paths that people walk up the side of the mountain all the time, but he just panicked. But he had his cell phone, so he was okay.
Aren't you going to be harder to spot from the air if you're hugging a tree?
Hugging a tree is a virtual thing, right? So what you want to, what that means, even orange is even better. So you don't necessarily want to be under the tree, right? You just want to stay put. And it's okay to find water, right? It's okay to get near some water and then make sort of all sorts of signals of where you're at, but stay where you're at. People will probably find you. Yeah, but don't get under a tree. So the kid that they didn't find two summers ago, they have no idea what happened to him. never found his body. And the best explanation is about an hour and a half after he went missing, it started to rain, and it was a cold, cold rain up in the high Uintas, high wilderness area. And they think that he was just cold and probably just climbed into a hollow log someplace, and they just never found him. So you don't want to literally get under a place where people can't see you, but if it's raining, you need to get shelter in a way that, because otherwise you die of hypothermia. Okay, so there's a whole bunch of motivational factors. I kind of spent more time there than I intended, that dictate it. Well, if I could take these motivational factors and turn this into a model for how victims might move, given things like terrain features and vegetation density and trails and things like this, then I might be able to say that there are attractor regions. Most people tend to go downhill, right, which suggests that the bottom of valleys and things like that are going to be places where you might have a higher probability. If people see a trail, they will often stick to it at least temporarily. And there's a story of a man who walked for 20 miles, was found 20 miles away from the point last seen, and he basically, he had a general idea about what direction he thought he should go, and even though he could hear cars off in the distance as he was lost, and heard dogs barking and saw lights, he kept on going in that direction, because he knew he was going in the right direction. But there's things like that that dictate how people should go. So what you saw here briefly was a video which is a very simple model for how victims might move. And the tendency is to cluster in low regions. This is a mix of people distribution where some go uphill and tend to cluster towards the top. And then when you're done doing something like this, it would be really nice if I could come up with a distribution for where the victims are located. So the student who did this work just convolved a two-dimensional Gaussian to get an approximate representation for the distribution of victims. And then what he did is he did something which I thought was interesting. There is data which talks about what is the angle and the radial distance that people tend to be found as a function of height from the point last seen. Okay? And so his goal was to match this. Now the data is very, very sparse. Okay? So he's got maybe that same shape, and maybe if he'd gone a little bit longer, he would have done better. This is an exercise in futility if we just continue to tune parameters. Because there's too many parameters, and there's too many things that we can't understand. So what we're going to do now with this data is we're going to get a whole bunch of subject matter experts. I mean, by a whole bunch, I mean three. And we're going to have them in five or six different situations do a coloring like this that says these are the probabilities where we think things are going to be. And then we're going to try to match model parameters to what they have. That's one end of the study we're going to do. The next end of the study we're going to do is we're going to do a search through this parameter space. And we're going to see, you know what, if this parameter doesn't affect the ultimate distribution, then it doesn't really matter which one I choose, and so I don't have to worry about that. So we're going to try to calibrate what parameters are important by matching them with observed data, and then throw out ones that are irrelevant. Okay. Now, once you have that information, what do you do with it? You search optimally. But the optimal search is something that you can't actually do in practice. All right? And what I mean by that, the optimal thing to do is to always beam yourself to the next highest probability region, take a snapshot, and then beam someplace else. Right? Well, when you have a physical platform, you obviously can't do this. So we're trying to explore, given that you can't instantaneously go from high probability region to high probability region, we want to know what is a reasonable search technique. And what I'm showing you here is that there's a huge trade-off in what path you use. So the path that you see stepping up like this, this is the lawnmower search in an area. The path that you see that's going like this is is one which tries to follow greedily, follow hills, right, and then propagate itself. And if you have things which are uniform distribution, oh, the lawnmower works beautifully. If you have Gaussian, it's pretty lousy, right? Because you're just going to, every time you step across the high probability region, you're going to accumulate a little bit. And what we would like is a search algorithm, and I'd really be open to suggestions on this because we're casting about a little bit. We want a search algorithm that allows ourselves to take probability regions, do some planning based on these so that we accumulate as much probability as quickly as possible. And then once we get that search algorithm, I want to take a model for how victims or how people see things and fold that on top of it so that we say, yeah, that might be the right thing to do, but I can't see anything from that angle, and then extend that search algorithm. Yes?
So So this is for the airplane. Does it have different speeds? Like, can it jump from one probability area to another one pretty fast and then continue a search in another, like if you have a bimodal distribution? Or does it actually have to go from one to the other?
It depends on how close they are. So these things have, the UAVs have a gimbaled camera, the ones we're flying have a gimbaled camera. And so you could slew over there pretty quickly if they're close together, these high probability regions. All right. But if there's a significant difference, which there is going to be in a lot of these terrains, we're going to have these multimodal types of things, you're going to have to fly over there. You know, so at what point do you abandon this area and zoom over? Now, an interesting thing that happened with this, unless you do an exhaustive search like a lawnmower, in a distribution which is kind of squirrely, doing any kind of jumping back and forth, you end up with a Swiss cheese thing with a whole bunch of holes of places that you haven't searched. And a real interesting question to me is, how do you coordinate that Swiss cheese with ground searchers and so on? All right. Okay, now we're going to talk about my work. All right, so if we're controlling the UAV and doing search at the same time, current technologies strongly suggest that you can't do both at the same time. Okay? I think that might be right, but we're going to try to do it anyway. So what we want to do is we want to explore four different perspectives. We're going to do four. We've explored others. We're going to explore four different perspectives for controlling the UAV and doing search. And I apologize for this being so small, but let me explain what you're seeing here. This is the video coming back from the UAV. This is in simulation, by the way. Oh, I got to run that one again. Oh, that's going to go in order. Man, I hate when I talk too much. This one up here is a chase perspective, which means it's similar to the navigation units in cars. We're going to be above and behind the UAV, and we're going to project onto the Google map, warp to a digital elevation map, what the video is seeing. And then the person can come in here and they can mark where things are, and they can get a sense for how much they've seen over time. Now, here's my working hypothesis. This is finally an experimental phase. This type of search, the chase perspective, is going to work very, very well if people are distributed along a path. Because I'm going to be able to take cues, you know, somebody walking through a snowfield, somebody walking through grass, I'm going to take cues and follow them. And I think it's going to work very well for that. But it won't work necessarily so well for a uniform distribution because the person can have all sorts of overlap. You see, this is the density, the pixel density as a function of where the UAV went. You see how it followed that path information. When I was a pilot subject in this, all sorts of overlap, really no sense for what's going on. So we would like to do a north up. Oh, this is nose up. And now this is a north up one. And it's a little bit easier for people to get some systematic coverage with that. So for certain types of distributions, this is going to be the right way to control it. We're looking at two others, and those two others aren't going to work, is my prediction. This is the one that is typically used in UAV displays, where you have some sort of map, some sort of projection of where the video is, and then you look at video on a separate screen. And our prediction is this won't work as well. All right. Okay, let's skip that. Okay, we're going to do experiments.
The way that the two view Google Map projected on digital terrain and the video overlay, you align them by?
We don't align them yet. Okay, so ideally what you would do is you would take this image and you would project it into the world so that it would map with the terrain, right? We're not doing that. We're basically exploiting something that we learned with ground robots, where you project a video into a map kind of context. You can dramatically increase people's ability to do the task, even by having that heuristic association. So we're depending on the heuristic association to allow people to have better situation awareness. Okay. Now, I would love to see that happening. One of our students is working on implementing current algorithms to do that. I'm not a computer vision guy. I'm glad people are working on it. I want to know which one people can use better, right? And I don't know. I don't know if warping it onto the ground correctly is going to work better, or if having this heuristic display is going to work better. And the other question I don't know is, if you have a mosaic, how much of that do you warp on the ground to do this? Because none of this uses the mosaic stuff, notice. And that turns out, I think, to be critical.
Don't you want to paint where you've been?
Yeah, so we're doing two different ways of doing that. We're looking at two different ways. The simplest way is to simply have a kite trail that follows a UAV around, and we see that trail wherever it's been. Right? People have been done that with ground robotics quite a bit. The other one, I think, will be more useful, and that is to construct some sort of pixel density for places that I've been. Right? So you get, right now he's just painting white on it. I think that there might be better ways to do that. But just a pixel density, and that'll give you some sort of representation to say this is the thoroughness that I've covered it. And I think that pixel density is going to be interesting because in areas of high probability region, I want lots of pixels. In low probability regions, I don't care if I have few pixels, right? Because it's a priority type of search. We're not going to the combing search. All right. So we've got some experiments set up. We're going to try that. All right, let's talk about future work. Camera angle, it's interesting both from a computer vision perspective but also from a human perspective. What's the right camera angle? What's the right height? Well, we know the maximum height because below a certain amount or above a certain amount you can't see anything on the ground. What are the right search heuristics? And if I give people the ability to follow a contour which was generated by a model, probability contour, can they make any sense of that? Will they have enough context for them to interpret the imagery? And so that's something that we want to look at. The next thing, actually, Takeo's stuff reminded me a lot of that. It'd be really great. Okay, so when are searches done? They're done in the daytime because you don't send your searchers out at nighttime into rugged, dangerous terrain. Now, they're always prepared whenever they go out to spend the night, no matter what the conditions are, because they might be out there. But they're not going to be wandering around at night, which suggests that you have so many hours a day when there's not going to be effective search. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to take this data, accumulate it into a large mosaic, and make that mosaic searchable? So what I can do is I can say, show me every perspective that you have of this. So you get different perspectives at different times of day with different shadowings, and you can start to use the mosaic as an index for doing the search. And that could be something that's done offline. You don't need real-time computer vision processing, and people can use that at night. Now, speaking at night, we finally received an infrared camera. We didn't have funding to do this, and apparently I still don't. Oh, there we go. And so this is, you've all seen IR cameras, but I put this in because we finally have an IR camera that we can fly, and we're really looking forward to getting this up in the air. Because this says, you know, maybe our technical search specialty, maybe it only goes out at night to search for people, and we might have a much greater success. The thing that I'm excited about this, I would really like to have some multispectral type of thing going on, where you're building a multispectral image and you're enhancing things that have any kind of heat signature and you're showing those in the video if you're doing it in the daytime. I think that'd be a lot of fun to do, but that's future work. So that's all I have for you. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, we have time for a few questions.
Yes.
Do you have any comments on the Jim Gray story?
Yeah. No, I don't. First of all, it's sad, of course. No, I don't. Then I elaborate. Sorry about that. I think it's tragic. I really do. I'm not optimistic, but I think it's a fantastic social study, and it could really illustrate the potential for doing a lot of good. Right. So I could see something where you send out 40 UAVs for a lost kid out in the mountains. And instead of having one searcher trying to make sense of it all, the ability to distribute that over the web really has the potential to do some good.
So I got contacted by some people asking, can computer vision do anything there? And we looked at the images and it was just, you know, 2 or 4 pixels that they're looking for. So it seems like, do you know if there is anything that computer vision can do in this kind of scenarios?
I can't speak on computer vision, but I can speak from the literature from World War II, where they were doing searches for things that were not lost but trying to hide from them in the ocean. And from World War II, the overwhelming impression is that you can't see a boat in the water, but you can see its wake. Right? And so, you know, insofar as that allows us to conclude something about the likelihood of this search, if the boat's not moving, it's going to be very, very difficult to find. If it is moving, you might be able to pick it out by the wake. That's the thing that people are going to see.
No.
Yes?
So the flying at night using infrared is interesting, but how does that relate to all the other work that you showed about what you need, what support you need to actually fly at
I'm not sure what you're asking.
Well, there was a lot of vision, both
computer
vision on the vehicle itself, for the autonomy and the interface that depended on vision. And my guess is that at least for people seeing infrared images and trying to make sense of when they're going to, you know, run into things or where they are, it's going to be much, much more difficult.
I think you're exactly right that people will not be able to effectively fly an airplane over rugged terrain using only IR. Because I think what you now have is viewing the world through a soda straw, controlling a vehicle which has multiple degrees of freedom, high degrees of freedom, and this is no longer just an image, it's now this blurred thing which is giving me heat instead of features that I normally interpret. Okay. Now, you can still do terrain following, and you can still do systematic search patterns. So insofar, you're not going to use this reactive search, I don't think. I think you're going to run into problems with that.
Are you doing terrain following?
So the terrain following is open loop right now. I have a GPS location. I look into my digital elevation map, and I say, this is this many meters above where I launched from, so I know I need to go uphill. And of course, you can do that conservatively. Okay? And so I think you can do terrain following and systematic search, and then have people interpret the video in a context still, and I think that that will work. But the reactive stuff, I don't believe will work at night. Now, I actually made a mistake in the presentation because I said, let's do multispectral, and then I said, let's do it at night, right? And that was just clearly wrong. You can do the IR stuff at night, and you can do the multispectral stuff in the day, unless you have an illumination source and we don't have the battery to do that. Yes, here and then here.
If you didn't have a budget constraint, why would you do different that would make things more likely to succeed?
So constraints such as don't search here?
Or, for example, then you can get a slightly bigger airplane that can have a heavier payload, and now you can bring a laser with you. Now you can bring a high-resolution camera that can pan and tilt very quickly, or a high-speed camera. What would you do?
If I had, so the question is a variation of, if I wasn't constrained by money and some practicalities, what would I do? I would have, okay, we might as well go all the way. I would have something which is a fixed wing to be efficient most of the time, but has the ability to hover. Okay? And I would require it to have at least 4 hours of airtime, because in 2 hours of airtime, you can control a tiny space. You can look at a tiny space. With that, I would have ground searchers who are following the airplane around, or maybe the airplane's following them around, and I would be broadcasting images up from them and trying to construct a 3D reality of what they're seeing with things that are highlighted. Right? There's kind of the ideal. So clearly I would like a UAV that stays up a lot longer. I would like one where I can hover. Right now we get a virtual hover by spiraling around it and having that. There's some good things and bad things about that, right? You get some funny effects with the imagery that happen as you go over. And I would have a higher resolution camera. Well, actually, higher resolution is not going to do any good with the communication channel we're doing. We don't have access to military, so we're dealing with communications that are fairly cruddy anyway. So I probably wouldn't worry so much about the high-res camera. So that gives you a feel for what I would try to do if I had the resources. Yes?
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience in having like rescue workers either comment on your stuff or accept using your stuff or maybe inviting you out?
So. That's a really important question. And we've been very careful, based on experiences with people who are doing urban search and rescue, to deal with the acceptance problem. So we have been working exclusively in the planning stages and in our preliminary tests with one search and rescue volunteer. With the goal-directed task analysis, we increased that a little bit. Okay? But we have not shown them the current capability yet, the full search team. And the reason why is we were very concerned about the acceptance problem, and we were also concerned about the overselling problem. Right? So we wanted to have a fundamental unit of technology that we understood could work in certain types of domains before we came in. You know, there's that real temptation for me to go in and say, I'm here to save you, right? I know how to do this. And I've been cautioned by people who've done urban search and rescue that that's going to really be a problem. So right now we haven't got we haven't really addressed the acceptance problem, except to say that we have been feeding videos slowly over time to the sheriff's office and to Utah County Search and Rescue people at the incident command level, and they are starting to express a great deal of interest, and they're starting to get calibrated about what these things can and can't do.
Thank you.
Yes?
One question I had is, have you given some thought as to what people could do proactively to help them being found? You know, it seems like every boat that goes out or every hiker that goes out might carry a wristband with a low power radio or something like that. You know, it could be as sophisticated as GPS that broadcasts or some sort of a GPRS modem on there, but maybe that doesn't work in the wilderness. But certainly low power radio signal could be really easy to track down.
So a lot of outfitting. So there's two answers to that question. So for people who are skiers, most ski jackets now have a little passive reflector for an avalanche sensor. So if you get buried and people are close enough, they can come over you and they'll get a signal to find out exactly where you are pretty quickly. Right? So some people, that's already happening. A lot of outfitters that are renting equipment to people who are going backcountry hiking or to scout troops that are going out there, you can get a passive reflector that then people can take an active sensor and they can fly over you, or you can get a little low-power GPS broadcaster, right? So if you have a low-power GPS broadcaster, you're in pretty good shape because they'll probably find you as long as you stay put. If you don't have those things, you know, a satellite phone's really nice. A cell phone's really nice. Even if you don't have cell phone reception, if there's airplanes flying above you at night and you open up and show the light, if it's the airplanes equipped bright enough, that's going to paint you. Or if you have your watch and you're doing that with the light, they'll probably see you with some of the camera technology there. So, you know, you basically take care of, this is what I understand, I'm not a wilderness guy, even though with the rugged looks and all. You know, stay put, find water, last through the panic stage, okay, because it's going to come. I think that people that tell you otherwise are either really experienced or they're liars. Last through the panic stage, and then make sure that people can see where you've been, right? Go ahead and knock some stuff down. And you may not want to light a fire unless you're pretty careful about that. And then you'll probably be found if you just wait it out long enough. Most people are. Oh, and stay dry.
What are the proportions of ground operators to outdoor UAVs? Have you ever had to perform a rescue operation for a downed UAV?
Okay, so right now the ratio of UAVs to ground people is zero, because we haven't used this in a real test. Okay.
But in your experiments, have you had multiple UAVs?
We've had two UAVs flying at once. Everybody crowded around one little TV screen because that was the only one we could get enough contrast right now. What I anticipate is, first of all, we will take this away from the incident commander. It'll be located at a different location from the incident commander, because a lesson learned in the military is if you have video, people will look at it. And so that means that the incident commander will likely look at the video rather than commanding the strategies. We will have one person who is responsible for tactics, what kind of search strategy, and we'll have one person who is operating and another person who's looking at video. So you're talking of a team that's probably three. And then you'll have one person, it'll probably be the operator, who will also be able to RC it in case you lose communications. Now, right now, they also have another person that holds the antenna. Okay, there's ways to solve that problem.
Have you ever lost a UAV and you had to go look for it?
Oh, yeah. Almost every field test. So yesterday, or no, last week, they had one that just flew away. No idea where it's at.
Your link seems to be still fairly stable.
What?
The video link seems to be very stable. Yeah, still.
Okay, so the video link has been stable up to about 3 kilometers away. Okay? So if you're aiming, that's all right. Once it gets down below a ridge, you got problems. Right? You don't get it. Because even though technically it's not supposed to be real line of sight, it almost effectually is. It'd be really nice. Right now these UAVs aren't going to, they're not recording imagery and storing them on some sort of flash drive that we can then download post hoc, right? So we're relying on real-time video and we're recording it. That's a stage we'd like to get to. Because if you could do that, then you could send it over the river and through the woods, and you can do searches in places that you can't actually see from. So when we do these field tests, we're on a medium-sized ridge among several, and we're really tracking where the UAV is. Now, you can't always see the UAV. In fact, quite often you can't. And when it goes down, it's a real problem. So when we do this in practice, we have somebody who's out there on an ATV or a bicycle. The ATV is more fun. And they're following this thing around. And recently, we added just a little siren to the UAV. And it's amazing because I can track the UAV. I know where it is with respect to me, even when I can't see it. Okay. And that's a significant issue, right? Especially the early designs of the UAVs, which were blue. You know, I'm all for school spirit, but blue, right? You just can't see them, right? We have this little siren, and you can hear that every place. Now, the siren thing is interesting. If you have a lost kit, I really believe you can do this. I don't believe I can get IRB approval to test it. I think you could modulate sounds and get a Pied Piper effect, where you could lead somebody who really wanted to be found to an area where you could find them. Okay? But the test that I have in my mind to see if this would work is to fly it over a playground. Right? And that's the IRB approval is not going to come for that.
Okay. Do we have time for one more question?
Yes. Analog video, so we have one, I don't know what the current frequency is, I can't remember right now, but it's an analog video signal that's coming over one channel, and then we have telemetry coming over another channel. And they're working on stamping some of the video with telemetry information with some success now. It hasn't been as good, but it's getting better.
Okay, I'd like once again to thank Michael for coming.